Welcome to Schoolin' Around, a podcast hosted by Branching Minds featuring prominent leaders, subject matter experts, and thought innovators with their perspectives on the current challenges facing K-12 education. I'm your host, Larissa Napolitan, a former teacher, instructional coach, and a member of the Branching Minds team, here to lead conversations with educational leaders and experts. My hope is to share with you not only valuable insights and knowledge from leaders in education, but have fun while doing it and shine a light on phenomenal educators and those that are on a mission to transform our schools and the lives of students. Since our purpose for this podcast is to bring you conversations with practitioners and experts from the field to discuss challenges of supporting students in schools, we had to share a special episode featuring Dr. Alan Coulter and Dr. Eva Dundas. In this episode, originally recorded for our 2022 MTSS Summit, Dr. Eva Dundas, Branching Minds Chief Product Officer, sat down with Dr. Coulter to discuss his experience leading RTI and MTSS as an educator, psychologist, and consultant over the past 50 years. Now for the conversation between Dr. Eva Dundas and Dr. Alan Coulter. Enjoy.
All right. Hi, Alan. Thank you so much for taking time to do this with us today. Just wanted to, give you a brief introduction. Everyone's got your bio when they're clicking in here. Just I would summarize.
I know that's the one my mother wrote, so she'd be very happy. That's good.
I will summarize your experience as really being one of the founding critical people in the world of MTSS. And you've approached that in lots of different ways, and we'd love to dig into that. But in terms of Branching Minds, you've also been really foundational in how we're thinking about MTSS. And we're very fortunate to have been connected to you early on in the days of Branching Minds to help us in our thinking of how we're approaching this work. And so very, very excited to be able to chat with you today and kind of share your work with the broader Branching Minds community. So thank you. Wanted to really start out with something I don't think I've ever actually asked you before, which is shocking, but why MTSS and how did you get into this space? Like what pushed you into this direction?
Well, that's a great question to ask me because, I've been in this work for 52 years and you stop and think about, especially at my age, you're always pondering, what's left and what's happened. And so I can tell you that when I began in 1969, really working with children and trying to make certain that, what I was doing was useful and meaningful in their development. One of the things that I realized was that the way in which we allocate resources to try and support the development of kids is always constrained. And so, are we really using our time with the best possible practices to make the maximum amount of effect? And, when I began, there was a lot of emphasis on potential. And so, we want to make certain that we can amplify, so to speak, or maximize everybody's potential. So it became apparent to me early on in my career that if we were going to do a good job in public education, we needed to pay more attention to science than to art. And I certainly work constantly on my art, but I have to be informed by the science. And so relatively early on, I also realized, especially when I got involved when I moved from teaching to psychology and school psychology, I realized that the process by which we operate to try and help kids get identified for their needs, that that allocation, so to speak, of what became special education in the mid 1970s was a process that had both side effects that were not necessarily useful. And so I very quickly became in the mid 70s, so to speak, involved in Texas, trying to say to educators, you know what, we don't have to segment and label kids in order to get everybody help. While that certainly is a useful process, it's one that does not necessarily always lead to the most positive effects. And so in the early 80s, I suspect, I started looking a lot at national data, a lot about what exactly was happening. And I was fortunate enough to be elected by my colleagues in school psychology to president of the National Association of School Psychologists. And one of the things that I did in the early 80s, so to speak, was to lead the group to adopt what we called advocacy for all children, and really an emphasis on the fact that what we know in science really needs to be applied to all kids, and that in fact all kids will evidence different kinds of needs over time. So we started out with that kind of advocacy, and of course it led to, you know, through my career, it's led to a number of things. Kind of response to intervention being added to the law in terms of Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which really sprang from an idea that standardized assessment alone was not enough to build a picture of a child's needs. And that in fact, sometimes an emphasis certainly on things that instruments, so to speak, that weren't directly related to improving instruction weren't particularly helpful to us. And that leaning on those sort of distracted us from really being able to improve instruction. So response to intervention, you know, got a lot of attention. But unfortunately, in some respects, once again, anytime you label something, you know, people tend to appropriate those labels and don't always bring with that appropriation an appreciation of the depth of knowledge and the real conceptual foundations. So, you know, now we're in the era of multi-tier system, just one system, multi-tier system of supports. And, you know, 5 years from now, it'll be something else. And, you know, that's what's wonderful about, you know, my career is that, you know, I'm still mid-career as far as I'm concerned. So it's like, what's going to happen next? You know, but you and I, you know, you and I have always, I think, had been of one mind that it's really around first principles related to the needs of kids. Yeah. And a multi-tier system of supports for me right now is really an implementation of those first principles of trying to allocate resources in a way that meets, you know, the most kids, I think all kids' needs.
That is so interesting to hear that backstory, and that, you know, you really have been thinking about this as a system to support all students efficiently and effectively, really from the beginning. You know, I kind of had this misconception that it really was introduced as this RTI special education referral process that then was later realized, like, oh, this is actually a really great way to target our support for students, not about special education. But it really started from that approach from the very beginning. I didn't realize that. That's awesome. Well, double-edged sword that it became what it did in terms of that period of RTI. About that, I think, so Branching Minds started in 2014, which was that 10-year period that schools had right. in terms of the reauthorization. And we weren't even thinking about this work as RTI or MTSS. We were thinking about it kind of how you were, like, this is a, how do we develop systems to actually support students efficiently and meet them where they're at, and not just based off of, you know, one data point about their learning needs. And so we got into this space, though, when RTI and the compliance needs were really being enforced. And so there really was, in the early days, it was a compliance process. Mm-hmm. And recently I've really started to see that shift, and people are thinking, no, this is just how we support children. And I'm curious if, you know, in your conversations, if, you know, since you've been fighting this fight about it not being a compliance process for a long time, kind of have you seen a real shift in that? Or do you think there's still areas that we need to push back on that?
Well, I think that I was taught a long time ago that education is a state's right, you know, that the federal government sort of fulfills a supporting role. But what's really interesting is that advocacy for children with disabilities has really been a model for people that are interested in all children receiving mm-hmm. an appropriate public education. So while education for children with disabilities is a civil right, you know, conferred federally, I think that it's really a civil right for all children. And the interest certainly recently of families in terms of making certain that their kids are getting everything that they need. Certainly the recent, and I say recent, the last 40 years actually, of looking at even trying to help children become literate, both mm-hmm. literate in terms of traditional literacy, and then also, you know, numerate, if you will, also being quite competent in math. Because as you know better than me, math is sort of the universal language across all cultures. And yeah. so I think that, you know, compliance has its role to play, because in some instances, families and educators need to be able to assert to others, gee whiz, you know, these have legal and ethical implications, and we need to revisit those in order to make certain that we're centered in our purpose. But I've been particularly heartened by recent efforts to also focus on results, to yeah. look to see, you know, that are we really getting where we need to be? I mean, certainly at the federal level with special education, the late Melody Musgrove really pushed that with the implementation of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, about saying, you know, it's not just about the legal aspects yeah. of each of the, what I like to call the 785 requirements of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. I mean, just saying that number
yeah.
convinces everybody, gee whiz, it's impossible to do all those things at once. But yeah. if you focus on results, then people really start to say, gee whiz, that's our purpose. Our purpose is not just process. Our yeah. purpose is process plus achieving outcomes and results. And so those two things always have to be in balance. And that's really, I think, an important aspect of a multi-tier system of supports, is realizing mm-hmm. that a lot of things have to be brought to bear. I mean, it's, you know, when we put into law like a functional behavioral assessment, we sort of oversimplified things. And I've been heartened recently by looking at even functional behavioral assessments as being something that's not as simple as people would like to think. There's no one cause. And yeah. so I've been working recently to try and complexify what we're talking about as opposed to simplify, because, you know, we really need to understand all of the variables. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that Branching Minds actually brings to this process, is the idea that it's not one piece of data. It's actually not one source of data. It's trying to understand multiple sources of data and sort of bring them into sort of a complete picture, if you will, of needs. Yeah.
How do you approach those conversations with people? Because it can be really overwhelming for people to make that shift into like, well, okay, I have all the data, but how do I make sense of it? And, you know, to do that in a way where people don't just get so overwhelmed that they turn off from that.
Yeah. It's the Goldilocks problem. You know, mm-hmm. it's what is just enough, you know, what makes it just right, so to speak, you know, not too hot, not too cold, you know, that balance part. And I think what you have to do is start with people's, you know, values and purposes and make certain that those are clear, and then try and bring in, you know, information that informs that purpose. And I think for most people, their purpose is around trying to make instruction and intervention as meaningful and effective as possible. I mean, everybody wants to know, well, where did the 80%, 15%, 5% come from? Yeah. You know, and I try and say to people, I've been saying this for 20 years, it's economic. You know, it's, you know, we can serve with our current resources, you know, 80% of the people, you know, kind of an efficient way. But then there's always going to be something extra that's needed. And that triage, so to speak, you know, that comes from, you know, the late 1940s, early 50s, when, you know, when we really had to make critical decisions about how do we meet the maximum amount of needs with limited resources. And resources are always going to be limited. So if I go back and say, all right, look, this is not as simple as you think it is, but it's also not, you know, it's not a what I call a wicked problem. I mean, wicked problems are where, you know, things are constantly changing. How do you get your hands on it? And so trying to take something, certainly any child that struggles in school could be a wicked problem. But if you apply data, and if you really try and work for understanding, then you can complexify it. And in complexifying it, you can also then select out the most essential pieces, the most essential causes, the most essential pieces of data. And, you know, you and I've talked about this before, you know, most schools, quite frankly, collect more data than they need.
Yeah.
They tend to add as opposed to subtract. And so, you know, I try and help people work through almost a subtraction process of saying, what are the most essential pieces of information that we can find useful in the moment? And let's work with those. And then using, once again, our principles of improvement science, you know, help people to, you free them up to experiment. And to try and find things that work, as opposed to simply being stuck with what's the present.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the conversations that we're having with folks. And I think it's you've touched on two key things there in terms of like helping people not think about these as just rules and actually engaging in what was the intention behind it. So we also get so many people who are stuck up on like the 80-15-5, and it's like, let's just think about what you're trying to do instead of thinking about these different rules and how we got to this. And so oftentimes with looking at data, we get people who get stuck in the, well, I need this piece of data, I need that piece of data, I need that. Right. And they're not thinking about, well, what is the data? And like, what are you using and how is it helping you understand this child and what they need? And I think once they can break that like process mentality, it does become a lot easier for people to think, oh, this, you know, I can apply my common sense here to evaluating this instead of having to think about this as like a rigid structure.
And you just reminded me of one of my favorite peeves, Eva.
Yeah.
And that is a lot of people like to do this silly acronym of Plan, Do, Study, Act, which, you know, if they go back and look at the origin, they realize it's a translation of Japanese that, quite frankly, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us in English.
Yeah.
But what's helpful to people to remember is that it's not just data, but you have to evaluate the quality of the measure. And yeah. You and I've had this discussion over and over, Ken. You know, people don't, if you simply take data and jump to trying to determine a cause without considering the quality of the data that you're getting, then you make a fundamental error. You know, it's really a critical error in trying to improve. So, you know, it's also helpful to have people visit and actually make a conscious judgment. What's the level of quality of these data? And remember, as a matter of fact, I'll show it. Let me make certain I do it right side up. I love to put this in front of people and get them to say, okay, make a conscious judgment about what is the quality of this particular data source. And we know it varies from student to student, because sometimes students are ill, you know, or they're distracted, you know, et cetera. And so even the measure that you get for an individual student varies over time in quality. And so, data quality is the other thing. I always want to make certain. Remember, I'm a little bit of a nut about that. So there you go.
I hear you on that. This is just an audio recording, so people couldn't see what you're holding up, but just something as simple as like, no confident on a scale of 4, no confidence, kind of confident, pretty confident, very confident, it doesn't have to be that complicated. And in terms of your evaluating, like, do you trust what data you're looking at?
Yes
or no? Having that simple conversation, I think, really is helpful. So we touched on, we've been, you know, talking about improvement science. And I know that's something that like you and I both are like deeply invested in. And I want to just kind of unpack that, especially the plan, do, study, act, like, you know, in terms of thinking about how we evaluate systems, can you kind of break that down, that difference in what this implementation and what that traditional plan, do, study, act process is versus looking at actual implement or improvement science and the differences there?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, and I think it's an important distinction because, I do love, I think implementation science has helped us clarify a little bit what I like to think of and what's been characterized as the three big buckets of getting things done. And so, you know, one of the buckets of getting things done that we often overlook is the context in which something is going to happen. And it's really the invisible culture, so to speak. It's the things that are below almost the level of our awareness. But educators are particularly keen about the fact that, you know, every setting is different. And because of those differences, sometimes things don't work. The second bucket, obviously, is having something that's effective, you know, something that really works in that particular context. But implementation science has then sort of pointed to the fact that the third bucket is then how to install it and maintain it over time. So for me, the distinction between improvement science, that's the what, and the how it actually gets done. And then implementation science is the how does it get installed and maintained over time? Because we know that, you know, people can sort of like say, well, I've tried that, it didn't work. well, they might simply be trying a not thorough understanding of what it is,
yeah.
But then they may also not install it appropriately. And my current work is really around trying to help teams understand those three buckets.
Yeah.
And, you know, and to have an appreciation, I mean, even evidence-based, you know, that term, which everybody likes to use, but does not dig deep enough to really understand that evidence-based is always situated, you know. And so even if something has been established as evidence-based in certain settings, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work in the setting in which people are selecting to use it. So I love, improvement science for me frees people up to take risks and to see how things work. But the risk is always measured, because if you're taking data over time on how things are being implemented, the how being implemented is the adult measures. And then how it's working with the particular student, those are the student or child type measures. And you need both over time in improvement science to really know if something is working. And if it's working, then how to maintain it, you know. And so all of those pieces come together to me to really help educators become more satisfied, if you will, with what they're doing for a living. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating than to spend your time going through the motions and not being happy with the results that you're getting. Improvement science changes that process and makes you much more experimental, much more adventuresome. For me, I think it's a lot more fun, you know, in teaching, if you can try out different things and see how it works. It sort of, it brings out the art of instruction, but makes it very purposeful, because it's always directed towards getting better results.
Yeah. I often think of it as being very meta, in that MTSS is improvement science at the student level.
Absolutely.
School level, district level, state level, it is improvement science in action. That is what we're trying to accomplish, is we're trying to make it better and using our data and course correcting throughout that entire process. We're not just planning, doing, studying, making a decision.
And you know, to me, the fundamentals is always around the measurement. Mm-hmm. And so, you yourself have invested heavily in making certain that we have good measures, you know. And so I think what's also been useful, especially in the pandemic, you know, and now coming out of the pandemic, is also realizing that one of the measures we need to have is student engagement. We need a lot more. We need to expand our base of measures around looking at how adults are implementing. So we have that kind of we sort of have implementation integrity as an equal measure to student performance. And then the idea that getting student voice into that measurement system in a way that informs instruction. You know, all of those are, measurement is the foundation, and it allows us to move forward taking risks in a way that we see as responsible and ethical.
Yeah. So we did warn my colleagues that we would go off on tangents, and I have idea how far into this we actually are, but I haven't even asked you what you're up to now. But tell us what you're doing these days.
Okay, well, that's good. I think that one of the things that, yes, you're right, we did warn our colleagues that we would run down rabbit holes. And you know, that's my favorite thing to do with you.
Me too.
So what am I doing now? Well, I work primarily coaching teams in terms of their effectiveness. I'm very wary of the what I call the six dysfunctions of teams and how to overcome that. And I have an appointment at the University of Minnesota as a research associate in a center that tries to help school systems improve their results. And part of that, obviously, is helping the Minnesota Department of Education implement an equity-based MTSS. I also work in Michigan with the Michigan Department of Education Office of Special Education, and I'm privileged there, you know, to work with teams as they try and not just uphold the civil rights of students with disabilities, but also try and help the state as a whole in its implementation of public education. You can't ever really divorce kids with disabilities from kids that are considered typical, if you will. They're actually just kids without identified disabilities. And so, you know, those two things, I really, they take up a lot of my time and they tax me all the time. They show me how, they show me how inadequate and inexperienced I really am, that, you know, I need 52 more years to maybe get better at what I'm doing, but I'm not certain I'll be granted that by my biology. So, so you know, that there's that. And that's kind of what I'm into. I obviously feel very privileged to be a part of a team that's trying to improve MTSS implementation in Minnesota. I'm very watchful and appreciative of the fact that in Michigan, they have a very well-established and flourishing system of implementation of MTSS. So in those two places, you know, that's really where my most direct experience is.
And it's been a long process for them to get to where they're at right now. Can you talk a little bit about specifics and like work that they've put in and how they're handling it now?
You know, Michigan's a great example of having a deep investment and being patient around the implementation of MTSS. Because, as I reflect on Michigan, you know, they've been trying to put together a system. They didn't always call it MTSS, but for about the past 17 years. And it's just in the last year or so that the Michigan Department of Education, who've always considered MTSS to be a project, kind of an endeavor, but it never, ever went away. You know, they kept improving, they kept evolving, so to speak. And in the just in the last 18 months or so, the Michigan Department of Education has actually brought into the department MTSS, and it is now a central function of the Michigan Department of Education, to the extent that, you know, the Postal Services acronym for Michigan is MI, those letters MI. So they're very clever at the Michigan Department of Education. They've labeled their function within the department My MTSS. So it certainly does create a sense of ownership, if you will. But stop and think, Eva. You know, we know that the average implementation period for taking something that's really well-developed, settled science to practice is about 17 years or so. So I think, you know, Michigan sort of right now, it should encourage people, stick with it. You know, keep striving, you know, learn as you go along. Remember, you know, improvement science talks about, you know, go slow, learn deep. And I think that's what you've seen in Michigan. And I think you're seeing it in other states as well. It's really getting
established. I think so too. I think so too. And I think that you touched on one of the key words there is patience, in terms of just having some grace with your districts in terms of helping them get this off the ground, and realizing that this isn't a quick fix. It's not a magic wand. Yep. It's a long haul, and, you know, helping people step in that right direction is really critical for states to help with.
And it's, you know, going slow and learning deep, you know, you're really trying to take those established relationships among educators in schools, established relationships among educators, you know, in districts and in regions and even at the state level. And those are all those groups, as they come together, you know, they become teams. You know, because just bringing a group of people together doesn't make a team, but you can certainly, as those teams evolve and as they learn how to work together and they get, you know, trust develops, psychological safety is established and maintained, you know, then people feel free to explore and to experiment. And then to establish routines that become stable over time. I mean, we all have, MTSS is a set of habits. And those habits take a while, you know, to get established and to form. And, you know, it's just like getting up in the morning, getting dressed and going to work. Yeah. You know, those patterns are, those habits are so durable. And they become, they reach a level of automaticity. We do things without even thinking about it, but they are working. And so MTSS, you know, to get to the level of automaticity is going to take a long period of time.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, you touched on, you know, these teams and work that you're doing into realms of coaching, of, you know, creating healthy teams. Can you talk a little bit more about what it looks like to get there and kind of what are those really fundamental things that schools need to establish in creating those healthy teams?
Well, you know, you're touching on one of my favorite topics. So, you know, I mentioned that for me, I see six fundamental dysfunctions of teams. Mm-hmm. And those dysfunctions, really, the challenge of leadership and the challenge of team members is to take those dysfunctions and make them functions. And so at the most elemental level, you know, it's about trust and it's about psychological safety. So let me distinguish between those two. Trust is always person to person. So, you know, it's around every individual on a team having a trust with every other individual on the team. So if you networked, if you mapped that network, it really becomes quite complicated. But once trust exists among all the team members for all of the other team members, you really establish what we now know we call psychological safety. And that psychological safety is the basis for productive discussion, for basically being able to look at challenging situations and challenge each other to come up with effective solutions, interventions, if you will. So that's the first dysfunction. You don't have trust. You don't have psychological safety. If you don't have that, then the team's never, ever going to get going.
Yeah.
So I move from that to then my second level is not being able to manage conflict. So when people disagree, you know, if there's trust, then there's respectful discussion. There's debate. There's norms, if you will. There's a way of interacting so that, you know, it's you seek first to understand. And so you listen better. And that second level really means that people can argue fairly, you know, that they can have discussion with emotion, but there's a respect that occurs as a result of that. So then from those two levels, then the next thing I move to are the mental models that people have. So that, you know, they need to share the same mental models. My favorite example is quite frankly around instruction. Does everybody understand a theory of instruction and share that theory? Because that's a basis then for looking at data and trying to understand what's not working in the delivery of instruction. And so shared mental models become then the third foundation. Then if I've got trust, psychological safety, if I can, you know, we can have respectful discussions and we are understanding our models of understanding data and looking at situations are shared so that we're looking at things with an awareness of what those models are, then I think we can move to commitment. And commitment is really around, why are we doing this work? You know, what's the purpose of it? And so we need a shared purpose. I mean, every school district has a vision. I'm not always certain that that vision is shared by everybody that's working in that district. And so if you have a shared vision, then you get commitment. From that commitment, then to me, the next is accountability. And, you know, everybody complains, or at least I hear a lot of complaints in MTSS about the fact that, you know, people aren't implementing interventions. They're not doing things, et cetera. We don't have buy-in, you know, and buy-in is an interesting word because, you know, it's almost like the conception around buy-in is, well, people haven't bought what I'm trying to sell. Well, to a certain extent, you know, we really need to talk about, you know, a shared kind of accountability, because people, you know, if people have an understanding of their commitments, then they become accountable for what needs to happen. And there's no guilt. There's no, well, gee whiz, people are resistant to change. Well, they are only resistant to things that they don't understand. They're resistant to, you know, they're fearful, et cetera. So you need to have that commitment piece. And then the last thing for me is, are we attending to the right results? You know, and so if I have attention to results that once again reflect back on our commitment and our accountability, reflect back on our understanding using our mental models, reflect back on the fact that we've had an open discussion around exactly what needs to be done. And all of that results from, we all trust each other. We all have that kind of shared sort of understanding and psychological safety. Then that team is a team that can get stuff done. Yeah. Well, you know, I've now talked long enough about that you understand, and anybody would understand how incredibly difficult it is to get there. You know, it's tough. And honestly, going all the way back to psychological safety, if leadership is not there, if the organization is not supportive, and it's so fragile. I mean, I just worked with a district yesterday where the superintendent, you know, has resigned. And so they're looking for a new superintendent. Well, think about it. It's November, you know. Yeah. I mean, this discussion for us, you know, it's in the middle of the year, so to speak. And everybody's psychological safety now is jeopardized. Yeah. So it's extremely fragile. It's something that you need to revisit, quite frankly, every day and every time that team meets.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone listening to this and hearing that, it's like you are dreaming that a team can function that way. But the only way to get a team to function that way is to acknowledge those components and be very intentional about that in terms of thinking, where are we in those domains, and what can we do intentionally to get better in those domains, I think what has to happen.
And think about it. Every one of those things is measurable. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have measures of, you know, we can do self-assessments of trust. There are there's some very good measures of psychological safety that, you know, that are self-assessments that where a team can actually check themselves out, you know, and there are measures all along the line of each of those six dysfunctions that allow a team to reflect. But it all comes from me. Remember, for me, it's all about measurement. And so it's considering the measures, the quality of those measures, and then having good discussions. So a team can check their temperature, if you will, you know, in terms of their efficiency and their effectiveness as they work together. And I really encourage teams to sort of every once in a while stop and check themselves out. How is it going? Because, you know, teams burn out, and they burn out because they're really not getting the level of support that they need, and they're not reflecting deeply on their process.
Yeah. Alan, we could talk forever. We were limited to 45 minutes. One thing, if you're up for it, we do kind of a part two of this, where anyone who's kind of listened to our, you know, recording of this during our summit or during the podcast, maybe we do like a webinar where people can actually join live and come with questions and kind of engage in that broader discussion with folks, if that's something to be open to. I think,
well, you know,
I certainly have interest.
The summit, you know, occasions for people to kind of come together and focus for a brief period of time. And if you think about the length of the school year, a brief period of time on something that they're really interested in.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you just heard me say, I mean, we want to return routinely and try and look at things as they go along. So, you know, I would be disingenuous if I did not say to you, well, yeah, let's get back to this again and yeah. give people an opportunity to ask questions. Because it's not just about you and I speaking, you know, it's really about, are we engaging others in the productive practice of trying to figure out how to make things better?
Yeah. And we definitely have some dedicated folks in the Branching Minds community who are putting in the hard work to do that. And I'm sure they would love the opportunity to ask you questions.
Well, and remember, I've already confessed that, you know, I don't really know a whole lot. So I love learning from other people, and people's questions, you know, they make me stop and think and say to myself, gee whiz, I need to look deeper into this or think more or, you know, reach out. So it's all of us getting together that really makes a collective knowledge.
Absolutely. I could not agree with that more. So thank you so, so much for doing this. And I'm very, very excited for the follow-up, because I'm eager to hear those questions and learn from you and our Branching Minds community. So thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Well, and thank you for having me. You know, you can tell, I mean, you and I always have fun. So this is good. So let's do this again, and we can have fun with other folks.
For sure. All right. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Schoolin' Around, hosted by Branching Minds. Branching Minds is an educational technology company using learning sciences and technology to help districts effectively personalize learning through MTSS. To sign up for Dr. Dundas and Dr. Coulter's follow-up Q&A webinar, check out our show notes or go to our website, branchingminds.com. And don't forget to connect with us on Twitter or Facebook at Branching Minds. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss out on an episode.